Today's Teisho will be on case 77 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Piyen Lu. Case 77 is entitled U Mong's A Sesame Bun. Engo's introduction: if you work in the upward transcendent way, you lead others by the nose. You are like a hawk taking a dove. If you work in the downward way, you place yourself at others' disposal, like a tortoise in its shell. If any of you come forward and say, there is originally no upward or downward, what is the use to talk in that way? I will say to them, I know you are living among dead spirits. Now tell me, how do you distinguish black from white? If there is a rule, follow it. If not, follow a precedent. See the following. Main subject. A monk asked U Mong, what is the teaching that transcends the Buddhas and the patriarchs? U Mong said, a sesame bun. Secho's verse, talking about transcendence, people come up with countless puzzles. Just look, all patched up, full of holes. U Mong stopped the gaps with his sesame bun. But problems still remain to torture you. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice on this beautiful spring day. Outside, all the trees are exploding into flower after a long, cold spring. It seemed that this day would never come. Only a week ago, we had evening temperatures in the 20s. And now it's going to be 70-some degrees today. And the campus is really just coming to life. It seems to me that we're maybe 2 or even 3 weeks behind where we might have been at this time last year. The leaves are just starting to come out on the trees, and all the flowers have emerged almost overnight. It's really wonderful to see spring come like this. It's hard not to feel a sense of excitement or renewal. It's really quite wonderful. It's interesting that at the same time that all this life is coming out, all this amazing life is happening. I've been involved with my father-in-law, who is 89 years old. And about a week ago, a little less than a week ago, I came home from the, I think it was the Sunday night sit, and I noticed that no one was home. And I thought maybe my father-in-law and my wife had gone to a restaurant to eat. But I found a note, and it said, we've gone to the hospital. So as it turns out, my father, I guess it was Monday night, my father-in-law had been doing poorly. He has emphysema, and he had a heart attack some time ago, like 8 years ago. So he has congestive heart disease and emphysema, and also he has a history of bleeding ulcers and things like that. So his health is very precarious. He has to take quite a few pills every day, and he has to he can barely walk across the room. He has a breathing device that helps him. A breathing device. There's some tubes that go up his nose, and it pumps oxygen into his system. Even if we go to the store, he has a little portable device. And without it, his oxygen content becomes quite low. He has a little device that you put on your finger. You don't have to prick your finger. It somehow measures the oxygen content in your blood through your skin. So it looks a little bit like a very fat clothespin, only it doesn't close as tightly as a clothespin. And you put it on your finger, and there's a little readout, digital readout, and it will give you the oxygen content. And when he's sitting in a chair, his oxygen content might be 92 or something like that. But if he walks across the room, it drops down to the 60s. Now, 80 is considered, you know, quite critical. So if your oxygen count is below 80, that would be a real problem. So his gets quite low. So he's really reaching the end of his life. It's like his machinery is really wearing out. And he's a very nice man. When I was young, he treated me very kindly. I often think about how nice he was to me, and how patient and supportive and so on. I wasn't very, I didn't really have my act together when I was young. And my wife and I met when I was quite young, when I was 22 years old, and I was sort of disorganized and confused about a lot of things. And yet my father-in-law always treated me well. You know, he always treated me like I was a person, I was his equal. He would ask me what I thought. He really never condescended. It was remarkable, really. Since he's had some setbacks, he came to live with us maybe 6 months ago, a little bit more than that now. And he's been, we changed our dining room into his bedroom, and it's been a pleasure to have him in the house. But now his machinery is running out, and I got this message on Monday night that he had had to go to the hospital. And I myself have only been in the hospital a couple times in my life. My longest stay in the hospital, and really actually, I've been in emergency rooms a couple times. I crushed my finger once working with some rocks, and they had to be stitched up. That was a brief period in a hospital, and I had a colonoscopy a few years ago, and that was a brief stay. But my being really in the hospital, like in a bed and so on, is an experience I haven't had for more than 40 years. I had scarlet fever when I was a kid, and I was in the hospital for for more than a week. So I haven't been in a hospital since then, and I went to the hospital Monday night. And my father-in-law was in the emergency room. And this was JFK Hospital, you might know it. And it's a very large hospital in Union County, and it serves a lot of people. And the hospital is just packed. Every bed, it seemed, was full. And everybody's running around like crazy. And I was walking by all of these beds, and a lot of people in this area were, quite ill, and quite a few of them were old, you know. And the person in the bed next to my father-in-law was an African-American gentleman, and they wheeled him in as I was coming in the room. He wasn't conscious, and he really looked terrible. You know, he was like a heap of skin and bones. It was just like a pile of flesh. Everything seemed to be sort of misshapen, and it was hard to see the proper contours of his body, you know. And I looked around. It was just like bed after bed, full of these people. And my father-in-law had very low hemoglobin, so they had to give him a transfusion, and they gave him two transfusions, and then they had to give him two more. And a few days ago, my wife had to go to work, so I met with the doctors in the morning, and they were fighting. It turns out it's interesting, you know. Actually, so many things are wrong with my father-in-law that they have to get specialists in each of the areas. So he has congestive heart failure, so they had a heart specialist whose name was Dr. Kovacs. And my father-in-law kept calling him Dr. Kojak. There used to be a show about a bald detective named Dr. Kovacs. And he said, oh, his name is just like the detective, Kojak. Well, it's Kovacs. So I spoke to Dr. Kovacs, and he said, your father-in-law has, Kovacs said your father-in-law has congestive heart failure. Before any operation should be done, anything else should be done, we need to go in and look at his heart. We need to run a tube into his heart and see how much of the tissue is dying, and then we need probably to do an angioplasty, which means you put a tube in the heart, and then you fill the end of it. It's like a little balloon, and you pull it through so it clears some of the gunk off the walls of your blood vessels. So his blood vessels are clotted with gunk. Yeah. However, he also has this problem where he doesn't have enough hemoglobin, and that means he's probably bleeding internally. So the gastroenterologist suggested that first, before they do the heart, they have to do they have to staunch the bleeding. They have to find it. So he ordered, Dr. Kovacs ordered a angioplasty and exploratory surgery. But this second doctor, whose name escapes me right now, he ordered colonoscopy and endoscopy. And so they put my father-in-law on, even though he was on death's door, they put him on a fast, right, and gave him a bunch of Ax-Lax type things to make him go to the bathroom. And then there was another doctor who is a pulmonary specialist who was also getting into the act, you know. And they were having a fight over my father-in-law, because each of them wanted to go first, and they all disagreed with each other's diagnosis. So it was like a chaos, right? So I went to the hospital and listened to each of their stories, and they kept filling my father-in-law full of blood, and it kept sort of, it's like a bucket with a little hole in it, you know? And they tried to go ahead with the endoscopy, but halfway through, my father-in-law just said, I've had it, you know. I just want to go home. I want to stop. And he said the doctor was so mad, you know, because he was halfway through this procedure. And he said the doctor just was furious at him, but he said, I just want to stop. I've had it. I want to go home. So he's come home, you know. And so he's come home knowing, you know, that he's reaching the end of his time. And I saw him last night, and he was very happy to be home, you know. He had come home around 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon. And on the way home, he noticed all the beautiful flowers, and really, he was quite excited to see all of this stuff. It's like for some reason this keeps happening to me, you know. my mother died in the spring a few years ago, and she had cancer. She had Alzheimer's disease, and she had cancer. She finally died of the cancer. And my brother died in the spring, as a matter of fact. He had a bone cancer. And so, for some reason, I just keep having this experience of, like, going to see people who are dying and looking around and seeing all these beautiful flowers. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it means anything. It just seems to be the way that things work out for me. But there's something very poignant about it, don't you think? Because life is bursting out all over, and at the same time, these people are leaving. And I think it's sort of the tugs at my heartstrings, because there's something, I don't know, it must be obvious in a way, but, when you know, that, like, death is right here next to you, this is like the end is right here next to you, everything becomes very alive. And it's fascinating to me how this is so. It's like, if you imagine, like, life just going on and on and on, you might just think, oh yeah, some flowers, you might enjoy them, but it's possible that you might not enjoy them very much. But I have the feeling that knowing this is like these are the last flowers you're ever going to see gives them a real poignancy, and just thinking about this, I think, brings everything to life. There's something about, the presence of, like, the end, the presence of knowing that this is it, that I think makes every moment very precious. And I think it's worth thinking about. What is that all about? For many people, I think death is just horrifying. Really horrifying, and the people have all kinds of, there's all kinds of religious teachings about what happens when you die. Some of them are really truly sinister and truly awful. So many people believe that when most humans die, they're going to go to hell and have, like, eternal torment. And that's actually told to, like, little children. So I think that those kinds of messages that, when you die, you might be facing, like, excruciating pain and actually, like, isolation and so on, I think those lessons are very bad, actually, to give to people. Because I have known people who have died with great serenity. Death has not been this terrible tragedy or this terrible ordeal. I've talked about this before, but, when I was a student of Genki Roshi in Seattle, there was a man who was visiting, also Zen master, also like a Japanese priest, who was dying of cancer. And he was quite serene, and the manner of his facing his death was really quite impressive to me. In fact, it really changed me, because I had never met I had only met one other person who was so serene in the face of death and who seemed really, like, untroubled by it all and actually had, like, real joy. This old monk would get tired, and have to lie down because he was dying, but when he was awake, he was very lively. There's only one other person I ever met who was like that, in my family, death was like this terrible thing. And when people would die, it was just like unbelievable tragedy had descended on us, and there was endless weeping and so on. Culturally, it had not occurred to me that death could be like this beautiful experience. Many years before I met, or a number of years before I met Genki Roshi, I had been a moving man for the Mayflower Moving Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. I had a job moving furniture for the Mayflower Company, and I loved that job. It was a great job, you know. I was in good shape lifting all this furniture and floating on it. You go to somebody's house, you pack all their furniture, you put it on the truck, you strap it in, you cover it with cloths to protect the surfaces. Then you get to drive to upper New York State or South Carolina, or, you know, sometimes even farther distances, you know. Then you get to unload it all. And for me, it was a real treat, you know, because I was paid just for sitting in the cab and driving to South Carolina. I got money just for sitting around. And they paid all of our bills. So if we stayed in a Motel 8 and we could have the free meals, I felt like a king. I had this job moving furniture, and we got a call one day. We had to go out to a local house. And at this house, we weren't going to move the furniture. We were helping to unpack some materials that had arrived, and it turns out they were crates full of paintings. And it turns out that the paintings belonged to an old couple who were living in this house out in the country outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. And the man had been a famous painter. His work had been exhibited in New York, and he was a nominee to the Academy of Arts, the American Academy of Arts. And I didn't know his name, but apparently he was quite well known. He was a realist painter. And they had crates of paintings that they were undoing. And pulling the paintings out. And apparently this man and his wife had gone traveling all over the world. They'd had just this fantastic life. They'd lived in Europe. They'd lived in North Africa. They lived in India. They had been in an ashram in India. And while he was traveling, he was painting these paintings. And some of them were sent to like his agent. But a number of them he had sent back to New York, and they had been stored in a warehouse in these crates. And this was like his retirement plan, you know. So he was a well-known artist. He had a good reputation. Obviously, if you paint too many paintings and you put them out on the market, you lower the price of your own work. So I think his plan was to bring them out gradually, as he, you know, when he was old, and, you know, sell them. And but what had happened was that the warehouse had leaked, and the paintings had gotten water damaged, and so a lot of these paintings had stuck together. They'd been moist for a long time, even though they were oil paintings. They had gotten wet, and the paint had fused through the canvases, the layers of canvas. And anyway, our job was to pull them out of the crates, and some of them were magnificent. I remember, you know, just being blown away by this picture of a mountain range in Morocco with some houses on it. And he'd also painted some scenes from the Himalayas. And he was like a great painter. I mean, these were beautiful, giant paintings. And they were like, you know, 5x6 and things like this, but many of them were very badly damaged. And the wife, the woman, I can't remember their names, but she was just weeping. She was devastated by this. And her, but her husband, he wasn't in the room where the crates were. He was in, like, the kitchen. And they had taken his bed and propped it up on, they had the four posts of the bed on top of some books. So the bed was up high enough so that he could see out the window. There was a big window. And he could look out at the fields and the forest in the distance. And when I was going through the house, I stopped. I was waiting in the like their library area, and I noticed there were all these books on, like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Gita was there, many other books. You know, a lot of books on Buddhism, and I was already intellectually very interested in this stuff, though I hadn't practiced, and I was very excited about this. And when I got to go in to see this man, he was really ancient, you know. He had long silver hair, and he was looking out the window, and he couldn't speak, but he had the most beautiful look on his face. Just beautiful. And I thought, you know, he knows something. He knows something. And he didn't seem at all afraid of any of this. That really left him, that left a big impression on me, too. So, anyway, somehow there's a way of dealing, I think, with life and death that's not so, that makes it not so frightening. You know, sometimes it's hard to decide, isn't it, which is more frightening, dying or living, you know? So some of you may have a lot of problems, you know, I noticed Tony was here this morning, and I'm so glad he could come. You know, the poor guy is struggling to keep the Star Ledger alive, and he must have times where everything seems to be collapsing around him. You know, I remember when I was in graduate school. Sometimes I just thought it would be so great to just die. You know. I had so many pressures on me, you know. I would maybe not be getting the grades I wanted, and I would go into these classes, and people were so much smarter than I was. And sometimes I would just think, you know, oh boy, you know, just to close my eyes and just go black, you know, that would be so great, you know. And you know, it would just seem like such a relief. And I was always afraid, you know. It just seemed like, what will tomorrow bring, you know? Some new assault on my safety, you know? Yes? Some new assault. So there's a way in which, you know, you think, oh boy, death, I can't wait. Really, you know, people? But then, you know, when people really are ready to die, sometimes they're terrified. It's like, wait a minute. Maybe not, you know. You might know there's a wonderful Woody Allen movie where for much of the movie he's contemplating suicide. And he has these same thoughts. He said, you know, everything's going wrong. I'm always on edge. I'm never at peace. Maybe I should just end it all. And I think he has like a gun in his house, you know, and he takes it out and looks at it. And then, you know, he's just these thoughts of suicide. And then all of a sudden he notices, like, I think, I can't remember exactly, but there's like a mole or something on his ear. And then he thinks, oh my God, it could be cancer. You know? So he goes to the doctor. And the doctor says, well, that could be cancer, right? You know? It might not be a mole, but something like that, you know? And anyway, they biopsy it, and he's waiting for the results. And of course, as he's waiting for the results, he thinks he can see. He goes he has a fantasy, you know. He'll go into the doctor's office, and the guy will take his hand and go, you know, it looks like this is the end for you, you know. And he said, oh my God, you know. And now he's terribly, if only I could live, you know. If only I could live, you know. And of course, it turns out to be nothing. And for like a day, he's so happy, right? It's like for a day he's so happy, and that's an ordinary human mind. You know, it's like we're torn between the stresses of life are so great. You know, we dream of like oblivion, right? That's a euphemism for death, right? It makes it sound good, oblivion. You know, and then on the other hand, you know, people facing death. You know, even my father-in-law, he said. he said, "That's it, no more, I want this to stop." And so I sat down with him and I said, he was also taking intravenous antibiotics because he has, among other things, a blood infection too. And I said, "So Jack, do you want to come home now?" And he said, "Well, no, not now. I want to continue to get the antibiotics, but I want the endoscopy to stop." And I was a little bit puzzled by that because, you know, when he said no to the endoscopy, it was like saying, okay, you know, that's it, no more surgery, whatever's going to happen. And I said, "So you I don't know how it, basically I said something like, "Well, you know, if you don't go forward with the surgery, you'll die, you know." And he said, "Yes, that's true, but I still want the antibiotics because I don't want to die tonight." And I thought that was cute. However, you know, both life and death are actually just concepts, you know, really and truly. I mean, something happens to us, right? Something does happen to us. But what we call life and what we call death are really abstractions. They're really abstractions. They're strictly speaking, you know, there really is no such thing as life. If you begin to say, what do we mean by life, it becomes very difficult to define it. You know, scientists have a hard time defining what life is. You know, isn't that interesting? You know, it's very difficult to say at what point life began. In other words, you say, well, these are chemical reactions and this is life. It's actually very difficult to say where it stopped being a chemical reaction and where it became alive, right? And so, you know, really life is not like a precise term. And actually death is not a precise term either. It's not. You know, life and death are just words. They're just abstractions. And the conditions of being that are available to us are actually much more complicated than that. Normal people live like in one or two or three small range of consciousnesses, right? But people who do Zen, you know, have access to different ways of experiencing the world. For example, last night there's a young man who's been coming to sit here, and he wanted to know if everything was going right on the cushion. He said, "I'm wondering, you know, if tonight's sit I was doing everything right." And he said, "Well, I was watching my breath, but I had all these thoughts." And he said, "I kept trying to push the thoughts back with my breath." And I said, "Okay, well, what happened?" And he said, "Well," he said, "you know, I felt like I was bending over sideways. And I was so convinced that this was the case, but when I opened my eyes, I was perfectly straight." And I said, "You know, wonderful. You know, you were in samadhi. That's deep samadhi." And I explained to him that you know, ordinary body sensations are, centered around like the self, right? And when the self, the fiction of the self, or when self-awareness disappears, we begin to experience our bodies in a very different way. And sometimes people feel like they're floating or they're empty, and these are not illusions. Please don't think that these are like illusions or hallucinations. These are real experiences of the body in a different form of consciousness. Yeah? What we call normal is not, what we call normal, it doesn't necessarily produce an awareness of what's really happening. It's just a conventional understanding of what's happening. And if you sit down on the cushion and you concentrate and you enter samadhi, you begin to experience sometimes your body in a different way. And this process of experiencing the world in a different way goes on and on in Zen practice. And we enter states of consciousness that normal people don't enter. It's just a fact. You know, you can wire up somebody's brain and you experience reality very different. Your brain is functioning differently and you experience reality very differently. You know, there's a brain scientist named Andrew Newberg who has said that he thinks people like meditators, like the Dalai Lama, he's worked with Tibetan monks primarily. But he actually said he thought their understanding of reality was more accurate than the ordinary person's understanding of reality because they're taking in much more information. And he said the ordinary consciousness is so fragmented and, you know, locked in like a defensiveness and fear that it screens out a huge amount of information. And he's studied brain activity and so on, and he said he thought that people in these heightened states of consciousness were having a more accurate experience of reality than ordinary consciousness could offer people. And I think that, you know, obviously I think that's true, because I try to spend a lot of time in that consciousness myself. And I do think you take in much more information. And you get a very different understanding of what we call life and what we call death, you know. So you know, if you sit on the cushion long enough, the boundary between yourself and the world becomes very thin, and it eventually disappears. It becomes, if you do this long enough, you begin to experience things that are quote-unquote outside yourself as part of yourself. That happens to everybody who does this. And indeed, the boundary between yourself and the world is very arbitrary. It's really quite arbitrary. It's true, you know, my skin is here, but when you think about what makes up your consciousness, body is only part of your consciousness, you know. Everything that's happening around you is also part of your consciousness. So it's very difficult to say, this is me and this is not me, you know. Actually, that would be incorrect. So you begin to experience the world in a very different way. You begin to experience many things quite differently. What you might think of as outside yourself is actually part of yourself, you know. And if people do meditation long enough, they begin to experience these moments of real blankness, you know, real blankness, in which there's just like nothing. And it's not, if you really focus on these moments of blankness, you'll notice them sooner or later, no matter what. But in Zen, we give you the mu koan, and people usually notice this blankness. Sometimes they notice it on their own, and the way I teach the mu koan, I direct people to that blankness. You know. The Japanese way of teaching would be to just say, here's the mu koan, and let you figure it out, and in 10 years you'd come back and go, you know, there's a blankness there. You know? That would be the traditional way of teaching. But basically, it might help to say, look for this blankness, it's here. You know. But when people encounter that blankness, at first it doesn't seem like much, but eventually, if you are not in ordinary consciousness, if you're in a deeper consciousness, and you're taking in more information, that blankness is quite a curious thing. You know, and I hope you spend a lot of time there and you explore it a lot. But if you spend a lot of time in that blankness, I think you will agree with me that what we call death is not at all terrible. No, really, not at all terrible. Now, you can say, well, you haven't died. Okay, that's true. But nevertheless, if you keep going into that blankness, I think you will agree with me. You know, when people in Zen talk about going into that blankness, they sometimes use the phrase dying on the cushion. Dying on the cushion. And of course, in ordinary consciousness, we think of that as like metaphor, right? That's a metaphor, of course. But maybe not. Now, you know, I'm not telling you what is what. Zen is all about exploring reality from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness. So please go into deep samadhi and explore that blankness, and explore life, and explore death, and then get back to me, okay? But please have no presuppositions. Don't trust language. Don't trust common sense, because common sense is a repository of ridiculous absurdities. Really. And don't trust religious teachings, you know, either. Please investigate from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness and just see what happens. But, you know, no matter what conclusion you reach about the nature of emptiness, mu-shin, you'll notice, I think, one thing for sure. And that is, when you are close to that annihilation, you know, when you're close to that annihilation, that absolute nothing, and then you step back into the world of form, everything becomes unspeakably precious and beautiful. It's like the beauty of someone who knows this is my last day and looks over at the flowers and says, you know, I never, you know, there's something special about seeing those flowers on my last day. You know, when my father was dying, I was with my dad when he was dying. I was fortunate enough to be there. And he also was dying of cancer. And he was a lifelong smoker. He smoked cigarettes and he smoked cigars. And he died of lung cancer. And the morning of his death, I went in to see him and he said, man, I wish I hadn't smoked. But the afternoon, when he was really dying, he hadn't eaten for a couple days, actually. And he was really ready to go, you know. And he said, you know, I want some soup. Yeah. What do you want? He said, soup. I want some soup. Yeah. Okay. So he went into the kitchen and there was like a can of like Campbell's chicken noodle soup, you know. And it sells for, I don't know, 59 cents or something. Since I don't eat chicken soup, I don't know. But it's not really great soup, you know. So I opened it up, I put it in a pan, I heated it up, I brought it in. And my father said, oh, you know, that smells so good. You know, and I had a spoon, and he had like two, like, tablespoons, you know. That's enough. He said, oh, that is so good. Really. It's so beautiful. So, you know, the Zen life is like that. You know, if you practice deeply, it's like that. You know, when you are really on the line between life and death, you know, and you turn back to the realm of form, and it's like everything is so alive, it's so precious. And there's something about going into that emptiness, into that blankness, that brings everything to life. And these two things are interconnected in a certain way. And please explore how they're interconnected, because it will surprise you greatly. So anyway, today we all sat on the cushion and we died a little bit on our cushion. And we're going to go out of this room and out into the beautiful world, and you can have some soup if you want. Or you can go to Souk Sagar and you can have some idlis, or you can go to a deli and have a sandwich, whatever you like. And I think it will be really quite beautiful for for all of us today. A monk asked Umon, "What is the teaching that transcends the Buddhas and the patriarchs?" Umon said, "Soup." Actually, he said a sesame bun. How delicious, right? Secho's verse, talking about transcendence, people come up with countless puzzles. You know, we have these dreams, right? These crazy dreams. And these crazy fears. Life is like a feverish dream for most people, right? You know, have you ever had a fever and you lie in the... you have a fever and you find yourself obsessing about something like, it's the number four. It's the number four, right? I mean, I've had fevers where it's the number four, you know, and I wake up, what am I talking about, you know? Yeah. But you know, actually a lot of life is like that. You know, a lot of life is just like a it's like a pure delusion, right? Like pure delusion. We worry about things that are so unimportant, really, you know? And we torture ourselves, really. I guess we think we have to. There's a writer I like, his name is Henry Miller, and he said, you know, I guess I had to suffer so much in order to realize that I didn't have to suffer. You know, I think that there's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, people talking about transcendence, you know, you could put, your transcendence is like, I'm going to win at this game of life, you know, I'm going to win. I'm going to become X. I'm going to do it. I'm going to win. You know, the situation I'm in right now isn't good enough. I have to be in another situation, and it's going to be better, and I'm going to get there. So that's transcendence. Talking about transcendence, people come up with countless puzzles. Just look. All patched up. Full of holes. This is life, right? All patched up, full of holes, falling apart, coming to be, and falling apart. You know, it's never going. Life is never going to be right. If you think life is going to be right, well, you keep looking, right? But it's never going to be right. It's always falling to pieces. You know, and we're terrified of that. So, what's the solution? Please die on the cushion. Umon stopped the gaps. The life is full of holes, right? And Umon stopped the gaps with his sesame bun. The problems still remain to torture you. Right? So what's the solution? Please, just keep dying on the cushion. When it drives you crazy, jump on that cushion and die. And suddenly everything is going to explode into life. Right?